Station number 4515, Reel 3.
Major Cooper, Reel 3. Was there any discontent on the part of any of the three groups of Iraqi officers about the extent to which they could rise in the hierarchy of ranks?
No, I don't think that there was any discontent. They accepted that they had British officers over them, and at the same time realised that in order to get a British Army commissioner in those days, there were all sorts of complications. Being a British subject, probably having the training required, and those sort of factors, which didn't make them really aspire to having a British having higher rank at that time. These officers were referred to, they were local officers, and their commission was a local one. The same way at the time in the Indian Army, you had the Indian Army commissioned officers, as opposed to the those which were regular commissioned. Now, I don't think they had any particular feelings or about it. They came in the levies on the acceptance that they could get just so high, and that was it.
Why was it just the marsh Arabs rather than the desert Arabs who were recruited?
I think because the marsh Arabs had been recruited in levies in the 20s, and had proved quite satisfactory, and that the desert Arabs, at that time, it was thought that they didn't lend themselves particularly well to becoming soldiers. Anyway, the Arabs from that part, I think, of course, the Arab Legion, without a doubt, they did recruit from the desert and did it very successfully. But they were their whole service was slightly of a rather more irregular nature than we expected of our levies.
What was the equipment of the levies like as compared with a British unit? Would it have been the same?
It was very similar. As far as the equipment was concerned, we had they used to wear a leather bandolier as opposed to the webbing equipment. I think later we also had the webbing equipment. The uniforms were much the same. They used to wear the levy type of hat, which was the jungle type of hat. Prior to that, just about the time that I came, the Kurds had all worn a sort of black Astrakhan hat called the claw, and the Arabs had worn the argol and chafir, which the ordinary Arab headdress. Then, for some reason, about the time that I joined, I think it was shortly after, they all went over to the levy type of hat, which was the what we know as the jungle hat. Otherwise, the equipment was much about the same. We had no MT transport, no MT to speak of when I joined, no form of mechanized transport. We had mules, and there were horses, but it was only later that we had our own transport. As far as weapons are concerned, I think we were possibly something of a poor relation in that when I joined, we still had the Lewis gun, and it was only later on during the war years that we got the Bren gun, which incidentally were captured from the Iraqis, the first ones, and we didn't get the 3-inch mortar until later. Otherwise, I think weapons were much about the same as you would expect with a British battalion.
Was the Iraq Army better equipped then than the levies?
Yes. Strangely enough, they were certainly better equipped, yes.
So they got the Bren gun?
They got the Bren gun much earlier than we did, yes. I don't know what other things they had. They probably had more MT, but what I remember of them, they weren't very good at any sort of maintenance of either weapons or MT, but that was just one of their failings, I think.
What was the attitude of the Iraq levies to the Iraq army?
One of dislike.
Why was that?
Well, I think it was because the Iraq army, well, first of all, it was a conscript army, and any of the levies could usually manage to avoid it, because it, although it was general conscription, a lot of people got out of it. And I think, first of all, it was a conscript army. It was very much controlled by the Arabs. In other words, you've got this queer thing in Iraq that, as far as the levies were concerned, that the Syrians intensely disliked the sort of Arab central government. The Kurds did, as you know from recent happenings, dislike them too. And even the Marsh Arabs had their ups and downs with the Iraq government. So the central government was not popular. The central government controlled the Jaish, which was the Arab army. And the Arab army was a conscript army, very largely. They weren't considered particularly competent. They had quite a lot of soldiers. And as I say before, they were fairly well supplied with arms and one thing and another. The officers, well, the typical attitude of the officers was that if a chap got posted away from Baghdad, even to some other part of the country, he thought he was very hard done by. So I don't think the officers were of very high order, and had very little idea of welfare at heart for their soldiers.
What contact did you have with the Iraq army?
At all intents, none at all. The only thing we knew, the Iraq army had a military mission of British officers, and we knew quite a lot of them, but we really had no contact with the Iraq army at all. We never had any exercises or anything like that with them. They were very much apart.
In what ways did you meet the officers in the British military mission?
Well, sometimes they used to come over to our messes, and or we used to be invited to their houses. It was a purely social one, and it wasn't really. They might, as far as we were concerned, they might just have been members of the oil company or anything else. We had no contact really on a military account.
What do you think the attitude of the Iraq government was to the Iraq levies? I mean, what was the feeling amongst the officers of the Iraq levies that how the government regarded you?
Well, I don't think the government liked us very much. They accepted us because it was all an agreement tied up with the treaty of us being there. But on the whole, they said their feeling was, well, look, we have our own army, and I believe at one time it was suggested that the Iraq army should come and look after the our own aerodromes and landing grounds and installations and that sort of thing. But that was quickly turned down. So that was the attitude, that we have our own army. Why can't they do their... what's wrong with that? Why do the British have to have their own ground troops?
What about the attitude of the civilian population to the levies?
I would say one of almost complete indifference. I think the first of all, you could well say that the attitude of the civilian population to their own government, whatever it might happen to be at any particular time, is rather shaky. As far as the civilian population, the ordinary Arab is concerned, particularly the sort of countrymen, I would say our relations were fairly good. I mean, one always was well received if you went out shooting or that type of thing. I mean, they were civil, and Well, they certainly, I don't think they didn't resent the levies or resent the British. In fact, I think some of them felt that it was an awful pity that when we gave up the mandate and that we subsequently had a there was a, the Iraq Iraqis controlled their own destiny. I think that was the very much the feeling of a great number of people, especially the Kurdish and Assyrian peoples living up in the north. You know, why did the British ever go? Well, they said so, but they certainly weren't unfriendly, and they used to welcome one. The more, really, the further you're away from Baghdad and the more in the country, the nicer the people were.
In what way?
Well, pleasanter, welcoming. Come in and have a cup of tea, or glass of tea, which they used to say. You never met any, I certainly didn't, and I don't think people did on the whole, any sort of hostility amongst the sort of tribes outside or when one travelled round in the north. One did find many of the government officials were a bit offhand, or when you went to call on them, which was the sort of civil thing to do, that they made sure they went away for the day. But I think even that was unusual.
How much did you mix with your Assyrian troops?
I would say not very much, except on high days and holidays when we had the Christmas and that sort of thing, and we used to go to the native officers and some of the senior NCOs' houses, and more especially the Assyrians, not the Arabs, but more especially the Assyrians. We used to go to their houses and have meals and that type of thing. It was more of a formal mixing. There wasn't really otherwise. They kept up, I think, pretty much themselves. There was always a slight complexity that the wives really never appeared. The wives were always behind. If it was a meal you were having, the wives were behind doing all the work. And the same thing happened when we used to travel around in the northern part in the mountains. They were welcoming, but it was always the men who welcomed. Wives you never saw.
Were the Assyrian officers in a separate mess to the British?
Yes, they were. They had their own mess.
Were both sides happy about that?
Oh, yes, because they had rather different ways of doing things to us. I've hit that thing. They had rather different ways of doing that, things to us, and if they did eat in the mess, very seldom did they eat in the mess, they wouldn't have been happy in our mess. A mixed mess wouldn't have been a happy state of affairs, certainly not at that time.
Why was it that in 1937 you moved from Hinadi to Habaniya?
Because Habaniya had just been completed and was becoming the new station in place of Hinadi, which after we left was handed over to the Iraq Army.
Was there much difference between the two stations?
Not very much. The new station, of course, everything new. There were new buildings, everything was new. Both were alongside rivers. Both had the great recurrent problem of flooding, which used to happen. And also, Habaniya was much more isolated. It was about 60 miles from Baghdad, whereas Hinadi was only about 4 miles from the city.
Did you use Baghdad for social purposes much when you were at Hinadi?
Nothing like so much as we had before when we were at Hinadi. We used to come in now and again for the odd weekend, but not more.
What type of social life did you have in Baghdad?
We knew one or two people. I mean, people knew people who they used to stay with, but I think more so we used to go and stay at the... there was a club called the Alwair Club, which we were members. We used to go and stay there, and we used to go to hotels in Baghdad, possibly for a couple of nights to make a change, but not very frequently.
When the war broke out in 1939, did you and the other British officers with the Iraq levies feel that the war was going to affect you in the Middle East, or did you think that the war that was going to be confined to Europe?
At that time it seemed very much confined to Europe, and everybody was saying, well, why can't we sort of be a way out of it, over to back to Europe where we can do something, back to England anyway.
And was it thought then that the French colonies nearby, like Syria and Lebanon and so on, were going to be permanently friendly?
Yes.
There was no anticipation of
No, because this was a year before the fall of France, and it wasn't until the time of the fall of France that this situation arose.
And was any new equipment supplied to the levies once war broke out? Did it affect you in any way in terms of equipment or manning?
No, over that after the war started, we got one more Arab company, which we raised us from 7 to 8 companies, but nothing more, no.
I think that whilst after the war broke out, you were at Habaniyo when the coup in Iraq occurred, the pro-German coup.
Yes, but that wasn't until 1941.
Can you tell me what happened as far as you were concerned as a result of that coup?
After the coup, of course, the country was very much occupied by the Indian Army. There was transit of Indian Army from the south through to Middle East, apart from the fact that there were far more troops in Iraq, and I think the Iraqis were doing quite well out of it on contracts and one thing and another, and therefore they got a bit more friendly. There wasn't really very much change, but from my own point of view, there was a terrific expansion went on in the levies at the late 1941, after the coup had taken place.
Had you felt the effects of German propaganda to Iraq in the early war years or before?
No, I think not directly, but we did know that it was going on. We knew about broadcasts. There was very much of a... if one did speak with Iraqis, they slightly inclined to say that the Axis have a good chance of winning. So there wasn't anything very much that we could offer as an alternative, more especially after the fall of France and the entry of Italy into the war.
What about everyday life as far as the effects of the war was concerned on you? Did your everyday life change very much? Was there a difficulty in receiving supplies and so on?
Yes, there was some difficulty, and any sort of luxuries were out, and supplies were beginning largely to come from India, but we were never really short. It was just the things that we'd rather come to look upon as normal, drink, etc., were in short supply.
You were at the defence of Habaniyo in May 1941.
Yeah.
Could you tell me the story of that, please?
Yes. We had known throughout April of 1941 that something was going to happen, and rather had expected a attack on the cantonment. A brigade was in April landing in the south of Iraq from India, and it was then that Rashid Ali, who had taken over the country, called a halt and said that no more British troops must land, and there must not be more than a brigade in the country, and that must only be in transit. The immediate effect on us was that the Iraq troops proceeded to invest Habaneh and occupy the plateau area on the high ground about some 1,000 yards away, and also on the other side of the river, with not less than two brigades, and he also had an armored brigade as well. But how the forces were allocated, I don't know. But a great number occupied the plateau. Just before that had happened, we had evacuated all the women and children from civilian women and children from the embassy and other places in Baghdad, and they had been brought to Habaneh. There were something like about 250 of them, as far as I can remember, and they were flown out to Palestine, and as I say, the investment started at the end of April, and the British were warned, the Air Vice Marshal commanding was warned that on no account would any aircraft fly over the Iraqi positions. Well, that was too much to take, and so on the 2nd of May in the early morning, all available aircraft from the flying training school were put into some sort of, well, they had been put into some sort of service sometime before that, and they took to the air and commenced bombing the Iraqi positions, and within a minute the Iraqi shells from their artillery were falling on us.
And what happened then?
Well, that went on for about 4 or 5 days. The trouble was that the aircraft was, say, were very largely improvised. The whole flying training school had been put in made operational with great difficulty, and these various not really very competent aircraft were required to do the bombing and one thing and another, and the casualty rate amongst these was getting fairly large, and the maintenance was providing quite a problem. There were also aircraft flown up to from Shaiba, 244 squadron, I think the number was. They came up and bombed. One or two of them were shot down. And so about the end of the fourth or fifth day, the aircraft situation was looking a bit shaky. And, of course, the Iraqis had got the range of the landing ground, and we were actually flying aircraft on and off from inside the cantonment, where we made an improvised landing ground.
Were many casualties caused by the shelling from the Jaish?
Considering the amount of shells that were piled onto us, no, not very many. I think on the whole, we were very lucky. I don't think the standard of marksmanship, as far as the Iraqis is concerned, was very good.
What was the morale in Habaneh base like?
Oh, pretty good. I think this sort of business of it may or may not happen had been going on for so long that people were sort of very relieved when something did happen. And as I say, the casualties weren't very high. There were worries, of course, because there were all things like the petrol supplies and the water tank, which incidentally was never hit, which, I mean, could have been a great problem if it had been put out of action.
About how many troops were there in Habaneh when the defence of the base occurred?
Well, at that stage, there were there were six companies of levies each would be mustering, I suppose, about 130, 140 soldiers. And then there was a company of, there was a very understrength battalion of the King's Own Royal Regiment who had been flown in, and they numbered, about 340, 350, all told. And that at that time, those were the, and there were a number of RAF personnel who were given a rifle and got into trenches and told to get on with it, who really hadn't had very much training.
And how did the siege end?
Well, the siege really ended by our own people, that is the levies and the King's Own and the RAF armoured car. So I hadn't mentioned there was an armoured car company also, RAF armoured car company also in Habonier, going out on I think it was about the 5th or 6th of May, and there was an action at a place called Sinel de Barn, which is just on the edge of the cantonment to start with, which nearly went wrong because there was more resistance there than was expected. And once that was overpowered, the levies and King's Own went out, and the rest of the King's Own who weren't involved in Sinel de Barn went out of the main gate and up onto the plateau, supported by the armoured cars and supported by aircraft, and drove the enemy from the plateau, taking certainly 400 prisoners and causing a lot of casualties.
Did you see the prisoners brought in?
Yes.
What condition were they in?
They're not very good. They weren't. They'd had a fairly grueling time of it, and I don't think their supplies had really got round them very well. And of course, it was a very hot time of year. It was about 120 in the shade, so it really was hot. It was as hot as it really could be, and the prisoners were in a fairly poor way.
Were the troops in the base entirely loyal, or was there any concern about their loyalty?
We were worried about the Assyrians. After all our levies were mercenaries. When I say we were worried about the Assyrians, the Assyrians were really at the backbone, and they were good fighters, and they'd proved themselves in the past, way back in the 20s and 30s, when fighting for the British against the Kurds, and they had proved themselves. And it was just rather wondered. Everything was very shaky as far as propaganda and that sort of thing was concerned, and it was rather wondered whether something could have gone wrong. But on the whole, they really stuck to us remarkably well. They were very good, and the Kurds, who really had less association with the British, the Syrians have had a long association with the British. I say long, but from after the last war. But the Gurkhas were pretty good on the whole. The one Arab company we had up there was slightly inclined to go to ground unnecessarily, but we didn't lose any. None of them tried to desert or anything.
You said that the water supply wasn't hit, but whereabouts in the base did most of the damage occur from the shelling?
I think it always seemed to be a general shelling all over the base, really. We got a certain amount in the levee lines. They seemed to be shoot rather indiscriminately. Nobody really quite knew who was going to get shot at next.
So it was just a general peppering rather than aiming at some specific part of the base.
It appeared to be, yes. That nothing in the early stages, not until the aircraft. The Iraq Air Force also were involved in this. They used to come and do a bit of bombing and machine gunning. But it wasn't until that the Italian and German aircraft started coming over later that they really obviously going for definite targets, so like petrol dumps and that sort of thing, which they didn't succeed. They did hit petrol dumps, but never the water tower. Also, the Iraq army were just within machine gun range, so we used to get, I remember in the levee lines, which was fairly near to the perimeter, we used to get the shooting at us from machine guns from the plateau too.